Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This episode is a listener question thanks to a good friend of mine, Tony, who thankfully listens to the show, sent me an email to check out a recent video by Toby Hemenway on redesigning civilization, which also included a question in response to that video. I've included a link to the Toby Hemenway video in the show notes and recommend you check it out if you have the time. The video is a little over an hour and serves as a historical reference for how humanity may have come to agriculture and a nice introduction to some of the ideas of permaculture. The video also, as the title suggests, sets up how we can redesign civilization with permaculture. I take that idea one step further in order to examine Tony's question. Before we get to that, I'd like to thank everyone who continues to make the Permaculture Podcast possible. Without the support of listeners, I wouldn't be able to do this. Thank you. If you've considered lending a hand, go to thepermaculturepodcast.com and click on the support tab. There you'll find out how to follow the show on Facebook or Twitter and options for making a donation. Again, thank you to everyone who is helping me to build a better world. So then, Tony's question. Say, for the sake of argument, that we lived in a fully functional permaculture society. As to how large a society, let's consider the question in regards to local, city, and national-sized societies. How would a permaculture society deal with an extensive drought and or other longer-term production-destroying situations as opposed to an industrial agricultural one? Before I dig in, I'm going to say that this is a thought experiment at best and a bit of a rambling one at that. Here's my mind as I'm pulling from various angles to look at the different points. I could easily spend months working out more and more intricacies, putting in references to support and refute various pieces, but I'd rather provide a basic response than to fall down that rabbit hole of seeking perfection and never producing something. For the sake of time and brevity, this is what I have for now. Also, given the complexities of any arrangement of people, a clear-cut answer of what this final society would look like isn't straightforward. Every situation in sight is unique, and thus would be every town, city, or nation that make permaculture the primary design system. However, I can speak to how the principles and other core ideas of permaculture potentially lead to a different society that can face a drought or other loss of production. To see how that happens, I'm going to walk through Holmgren's widely publicized 12 principles and to be mindful of the three ethics. For those of you who haven't heard them in a while, or if this is your first introduction to permaculture, here are those ethics and principles. Our ethics are care for the earth, care for the people, and set limits to consumption and reproduction and return the surplus. The 12 principles are observe and interact, catch and store energy, obtain a yield, apply self-regulation and accept feedback, use and value renewable resources and services, produce no waste, design from patterns to details, integrate rather than segregate, use small and slow solutions, use and value diversity, use edges and value the marginal, creatively use and respond to change. So we have the premise of the question. A disaster occurs, destroying long-term production. Though it could be anything, I'll focus on Tony's suggested drought as an illustrating point. The principles, being principles and not techniques, apply in the same way to any other problem you may encounter. Even if that's a wandering horde of zombies or keeping rebels out of your new planet-destroying orbital base. The specific design elements and techniques that come in to solve the problem at hand, such as a strong fence to keep out those zombies, if they're the slow shambling Romero types, or ensuring you have good security in place, and small enough exhaust ports that some lucky farm boy doesn't have the skills to hit that now half-meter target. And we come to those solutions by applying the principles and ethics. Though, I don't know how you'd account for the wisdom of a ghostly Obi-Wan Kenobi encouraging that farm boy to use the Force, but I digress. Now then, with the 12 principles as a guide for figuring out how the society would differ from the world we have today, let's go. Observe and interact. This principle gets us into the world examining the site and what happens there. Through the use of zone, sector, and vector analysis, the internal, external, positive, and negative influences become clear, including accepting the unknowns. By knowing what disasters are most likely, we can plan for the eventuality and consider the worst-case scenario. We then design solutions into the system, expecting that one day the disaster will come. Knowing there is a drought guides how we will respond to it. Catch and store energy. Another reminder to use as much of what's coming through a particular system as possible in order to slow the progress of entropy. Living systems represent the best way to do that through the plants and animals, as well as people and their knowledge. Consider the impacts of a drought. There's a long-term drop in food production, so we need to store food, our own energy for the future. When it comes to our plants, that means building nutrients in the soil and also using techniques to capture water in the soil, which leads to many of the things that we do in permaculture, such as swales to help limit runoff or to divert water where it needs to go, and mulching. Knowledge is another form of energy storage if you want to play loose with the idea of energy, but figure this more to be the wisdom of those around us and who came before us. Planning for drought, we can investigate techniques to help in that situation that includes common ideas, as the previously mentioned mulching, but also more specifically, things we might not normally encounter regularly, like dry farming techniques, such as my friend Aaron Harvey mentioned for tomatoes. Again, with any emergency, the best time to gain the necessary skills are before the problem arises, so we're constantly learning new things early and often. Obtain a yield. Whether the disaster occurs today or 10 years from now, preparing ahead of time and considering what yields we want to obtain allow us to still produce something useful from the system. What I mean is that it's possible to spend so much preparing for an eventuality that in the time until it occurs, the system costs us more than we gain. We shouldn't be in a place where we win or lose, but rather to be perpetually gaining a little bit more and ever improving. But don't take that as a commandment to seek ever-increasing growth, as the only thing I've known of that can grow forever is cancer, and that'll kill you. Instead, we expand the yields we get from the system. An example of this is that storing water in tanks is a great improvement if it benefits us now and in the future. Capturing rainwater to water plants may aid the recharging of the local aquifer because of the decreased need to use water from that resource, allowing that preserved aquifer to be something that we turn to when the drought comes. Storing food saves us should the drought mean there is less food, but spending money we don't have to build those reserves could put you in dire straits. The same goes for spending resources to put away food and then failing to use it. We don't gain the necessary yield from our expenditure of energy and introduce unnecessary waste to the system. Apply self-regulation and accept feedback. Like a recession, by the time we realize a drought is upon us, we're already in trouble. This isn't something that happens suddenly and is gone, like a tornado or single storm, but is a long-term disruption that may happen over a large area. As long-term planners, after even a few days with no rain or an increased need for irrigation, we begin making decisions on how to handle the situation. The community begins coming together to figure out how to get the necessary work done. The nation begins directing available volunteers where they can do the most good. We are proactive to the problem that arises rather than being reactive. Use and value renewable resources and services. We use renewable resources and services because they're the ones that can be managed easier on a small scale by individuals and communities. Though the usage could be extractive, say, cutting down a tree, planting another one or allowing succession to occur regenerates that loss, so it is only temporary. In turn, this preserves the limited, scarce, and non-renewable resources, so that should a problem arise, a small portion may be used to help solve the problem. For our drought conditions, this could be fuel for a tanker truck to deliver water on site to those in need, or to move resources long distances, should the local ones reach critically low stores. Produce no waste. For produce no waste, the five R's come to mind: refuse, reuse, reduce, repair, recycle, which all tie into the third ethic to reduce consumption and have a surplus to share. For our drought, that means concentrating on what matters most in the landscape and community to move forward and overcome the problem at hand. To refuse to produce any waste, to reuse as much as possible in light of the current problem, reduce the use of water to preserve the landscape, possibly by asking people to work together to reduce water use so that that can be diverted to our plants, to continually repair our soil so that it grows and stores more nutrients and more water, and to recycle through the process of compost. Similarly, there's no reason to grow food that an individual or community won't eat. My wife loves cherry tomatoes, but is the only member of our family who really eats them with any regularity. One cherry tomato plant is enough for us and our neighbors around us. Growing 10 such plants doesn't make sense, even if there's more than that currently growing that have escaped into their own wild throughout the yard. Designed from patterns to details, patterns help focus our planning, not only in the assemblage of the parts, but also in what can happen. Think about a garden you've raised or what you hear in the news about agriculture. If there's a long dry spell, what are the first plants to begin drooping, then wilt, and finally die? How would that influence what you grow? In the community, you can also find out, through those acts of observation and being involved, who the leaders are, whether those people think they're in charge or not. Have you ever noticed how there's someone who people defer to when making certain decisions, or who step up and volunteer when something needs to be done? They become leverage points to turn to when problems arise, but also in turn, they're the Jesus screws you need to keep tight when they're called upon. Within my own family, those people are my father, on his side, and my maternal grandmother, on my mother's. Who can you identify in your own location or family to turn to should the wheels come off the system that you can rely on to make a difference? Integrate rather than segregate. We bring things together in permaculture, be they the plants and animals in a yard or the members of a community. Whether you think individuals are dumb and groups are smart or groups are dumb and individuals are smart, bringing everyone together lends additional intellectual, social, and other yields that help solve problems. Though your neighbor may not be strong enough to lug water down the road to the gardens growing food, they may have a wheelbarrow you can borrow to get their water there. Or an old farmer may remember how they made it through a drought years before, aiding your position. Or you may know someone who's a plumber who will help come out and design an in-ground irrigation system to make the efficient use of that water. But if we don't bring the community together to face these kinds of problems, we're left on our own. If we fail, there's no one to help us back up again. Use small and slow solutions. As the drought becomes apparent, rather than making huge, drastic changes, we begin with little ones. Again, looking for those leverage points where the smallest action produces the most good. What that is and what we need to do will vary depending on scale. The home user may decide to eat through some stored food that don't require water to cook, so they can use the water they save to continue watering the plants in the field. A large producer may make the choice to abandon one or two crops in the beginning so that they can more fully focus on others. As time passes and the conditions continue, the choice is made, adapt to the situation incrementally. The line, "Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater," comes to mind. Because if we quickly and completely abandon something, and then the rains come, the solution that we chose could be worse than the problem. Use and value diversity. Permaculture abhors monocultures as much as nature. Using diversity of plants, animals, and people keep our system from having a single point of failure. Even though a few parts may not make it, others may thrive, and the overall system survives. Use edges and value the marginal. Permaculture systems allow for more diversity and ways to integrate the pieces of the system together by looking for the little places to make and use change. Everyone and everything within the system contributes something. It's up to our observation and imagination to find it, to look where others might not, and then make use of it. Not in a non-renewable extractive way, but in a functional, regenerative one. Creatively use and respond to change. With this idea, we can engage the artist and creator rather than the engineer and logician to move through the problem from something negative and life-defeating to something positive, affirmative, and abundant. As a drought occurs and deepens, we can use the drier conditions to our advantage. As certain previous plants die off, their passing creates space for new ones, which could include bringing in plants with lower water requirements or that will grow in poor, compacted soils. So we again build for the long term. Techniques that seemed unnecessary in a world without a drought get tried and tested, be those a change in mulching strategies, or using something like Xy where we plant in the bottom of a shallow hole, or smoothing out a soil surface so that the ground itself directs dew towards plants on now barren spaces. We could also use this as an opportunity to bring together our community with more meals cooked and eaten collectively within a neighborhood to reduce the amount of water we use, and to use an economy of scale to cook food for many. And that's just kind of a shotgun approach to looking at this drought and how these principles lead to techniques that allow us to prepare and respond to the disaster. I want you to hold on to those for a few minutes as I want to walk through a quick rundown of the industrial agricultural model. The industrial agriculture model that currently exists suffers from a few problems in regards to responding to a disaster like a drought. One is reliance on our machinery, some of which have limited applications for what they can and cannot plant or harvest. Needing to retool a farm because of ongoing crop failures is an expensive prospect. Now multiply that over many, many farms. What would that impact be on food prices and stability? Look at the exploration of corn-based ethanol in the United States several years ago and the impact on world food prices. I also recently read an article discussing whether or not it's worthwhile to subsidize and produce ethanol to add to gasoline, given the recent impact of drought on food production in the United States this year. Ending that usage may keep food prices in check. But what about next year, or the year after that if changes aren't made now? Which leads me to another issue, short-term thinking. Market forces and the demands placed on farmers, as I understand things, limit how far out someone can plan. Also, a demand for financial profit, especially among multinational corporations that require a profit to satisfy shareholders, produces short-term gains at the potential expense of the long-term. The head of a company may have the best intent for implementing a 30 or 50-year vision, but when they need to go before a board every quarter or once a year and talk about losses as part of that long-term plan, unless everyone involved, including those investors, are on board, what's the likelihood that leader keeps their job? Another issue from short-term thinking that comes to mind is reliance on extractive and functionally non-renewable resources. Initially, the drought may not appear that bad to the farmers in the current model because they can turn on well pumps and pull water from the aquifer to irrigate fields. But if the recharge rate of the aquifer is lower than the irrigation rate, the groundwater can become depleted. For more on that, I've included a link to the Wikipedia page for the Ogallala Aquifer, which is one place where this kind of overpumping is a concern. This also occurs in areas with high water tables and shallow wells. The solution for these areas may be to sink a deeper well, but this further exacerbates the issues for others. And something else that I ran across while putting the show together is a news article about the depletion of water resources in the Middle East, which I'll also include a link to. If you wonder why water rights are such an issue in some areas, and conversations about future resource conflicts could revolve around water, it's not hard to imagine what would happen if we can't grow crops because of a lack of water, or the impact that a lack of fresh drinking water would have. It really is a concern, and there are ways that we can help mitigate that through many of the techniques that we have. But the industrial agricultural model by itself also doesn't do much to build topsoil. Drive by a field at the end of harvest and look at the stubble sticking up and all that bare ground exposed to the elements. Stand near one during a hard late summer rain and watch the runoff first clear, turn tan, and then brown, and if you stand there long enough, almost black, as the process of erosion carries away that soil our food grows in. Importing fertilizers can help feed plants as we lose soil and its fertility, but what happens when there's nothing to grow in? Look at images of the Dust Bowl for an idea of how bad things could get in the long term for soil just being stripped away. A figure that I've heard is that we're depleting soil anywhere between 10 to 100 times faster than the rate at which it regenerates. I'll try to find a link to verify that and include in the show notes. Short-term thinking also leads to management issues for how we use and value resources. Markets, as I understand them, and I recognize that my viewpoint is limited, work largely around the economic role of resources and financial capital. Without being able to assign a fair financial value to resources, or failing to assign a value at all, exacerbates management problems of limited resources. As I study natural resources law and policy, I'm beginning to see the broad view and why we run into so many issues between industry, economists, conservationists, and activists in the current model of agriculture and industry. Thinking about that article co-authored by Ethan Rowland about the 8 forms of capital, many of our markets focus on such a limited number of those ideas that really reduce our ability to determine their function and role and value. Where I think the conservationists and activists in many cases are seeing these other reasons for why they're interested. Not that one side is necessarily more narrow or broad, but just that the difference in the way that they view these issues makes it hard to communicate in a functional way and develop real functional solutions. If you'd like to find out more about those kinds of ideas, I'll put links in the show notes to information on things like extractive resources, non-renewable resources, sustainable use, the commons, the precautionary principle, externalities, and possibly others that didn't make it into my notes while putting together this episode. So that's a short overview of some of the problems I see within the current model that we have. I know that there are other models that exist and there are other ideas that are being implemented, but on the broad scale, those are the problems, at least here in the United States. Within the bounds that it exists, however, the current model more or less works. Billions of people get fed off this system, and the response to issues work because of the resources available to do so. My biggest concern, however, as it relates to Tony's question, is that this model isn't sustainable in the long term because of all the pieces that are required for it to work, not knowing if we'll find the tools and technologies to make it work in time, which is what leads me to the permacultured society. Let's take those bits and pieces from the principles and tie them all together with a more complete vision of what the society looks like and why permaculture in this case leads to people less impacted by the problem. I think that a permacultured society ultimately leads us towards, to borrow the term from Chuck Marsh, a neo-horticultural revival, which creates resiliency and regeneration as the underpinnings of society. To make that happen, a shift needs to occur where more people produce food on a local scale. Figures I've seen and calculated on my own come to a minimum of about 10% of a society's population would need to be producing food via horticulture. Whether on their own property or their neighbors, in a yard or on a rooftop, space needs to be opened up to allow tending where we are, not far away. Because we focus on the local and generating a yield and a surplus, we take care of those located close to us spatially, reducing the need for someone else far away to do the same. However, should the conditions allow it, we can transfer some of those resources to a place that needs them. For the drought, that's food to feed the hungry. If we're in an okay place, we can move that food to where it needs to go. If not, then we ask for help. That focus on local and renewable resources saves the use of non-renewables so that we can use them when appropriate, reducing the feeling they're scarce and allowing for the feeling of abundance from what we have ready access to, so we don't live in a place of fear and can continue to make positive, cooperative decisions. Governance, in my mind, would also be largely on a local scale to make decisions meaningful for the people in a community. Just as the needs of someone in one country and with one culture may not meet the needs of someone halfway across the world, the same goes from state to state and city to city, or town to city, or nation to city, and all the other permutations. However, because of a focus on cooperation, the usefulness of a state or nation doesn't go away. The ability to coordinate on a large scale and shift and move resources around, well beyond the community level, is useful. But I do see that the size of government could be considerably smaller on those larger scales if the communities involved aided and worked with one another while keeping what they have. That relocalizes economies and lessens the impact of larger scale disasters from occurring, but if they do, there's the will and direction to work through the problems and move forward. When larger scale help arrives, they should, to borrow from Ethan Hughes, meet the community where they are and work together, under the guidance of local leadership, not assume control of the situation. With those ideas set out, now to focus more on the long-term drought with a permaculture society narrative. As the drought begins, because of water conservation techniques, soil building, integrative pest management, and other permaculture standards, the food system is already resilient to many basic problems. A mild drought may elicit no change to practices at all, or any noticeable impact. But, as the lack of rain begins to take a toll, the individuals tending to the horticultural plots see what plants are starting to fail and which ones thrive. They speak with their colleagues, the other growers, to see what's working where and what's not, to begin sorting out solutions in their own space and helping those around them save what they can. This early stage also begins the communication process to other communities to find out the extent of the issue and begin seeing where the drought is localized and who is, no pun intended, weathering the situation the best. As that information comes through and the drought begins to worsen, the information is passed to community leaders who help put together broader scale plans to help the growers continue to produce their food and get it to market. The community can be informed, which in turn keeps fear from growing by being honest and knowing what is and isn't happening, as well as how everyone can help work the plan. From there, as shortages do arise and problems become more long-term, different communities can see about shifting their resources to help those in need on an as-needed basis. And those resources may include putting together community action teams who go out and help other communities bring in food for harvest or process it for storage, or any other of the number of myriad things that could come in with this kind of issue. And then this scales up from there, from the communities to the national level, if a large area is impacted, that state or nation or whatever broad form of governments and interaction that exists is, can be looking at where and how to move things to where they're needed to provide relief as necessary, and begin to pull information from places where the local communities may not have access to get it on the ground so that the local people can make the best decisions possible for themselves with this new information. The interconnectivity of the permaculture design system to interoperate on many different levels plays the key role in allowing for the resiliency that permeates a design stemming from the principles and ethics. Everything that makes permaculture permaculture is what makes it work. Across scales, across disciplines, across locations, we use these core ideas to develop what we need on the go in a flexible way that allows us to respond to any situation. But all this is fun to put together because it's predicated by removing the hardest part. I can look at the model as we currently have it, and I can envision what a permaculture society might look like and how it could react, but I didn't have to work out how we get to a permaculture-oriented society. In this case, I got to assume that it already exists and just play with it and toss some things around. But as of yet, I don't know how we get to that place of resiliency and regeneration. But as I turn that idea around and different things bubble up from underneath, I'm sure that I'll come to some ideas and share them with you once they're mature, and we can have a conversation about making something like this happen. In the meantime, do you think that permaculture could lead to a more resilient and regenerative society? Do you have any insights into things I missed that you feel are important to the conversation? Let me know. Leave a comment in the show notes. Email me, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. With Valentine's Day and my wife's birthday coming up, I'm going to be spending some time with my family, but do have something fun and lighthearted for Friday's episode. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.